Welcome to York Hospital Radio Meets, a podcast from York Hospital Radio.
York Hospital Radio.
Today we are joined by one of the most recognisable voices in football commentary, recognisable because he's been commentating for over six decades, covering countless iconic moments at all levels of the game, and I'm delighted to have him here speaking to York Hospital Radio about his long and distinguished career. So welcome, John Helm. And I wanted to go right back to the start, really, in your first ever football match, which happened to be against my team, York City, in October 25th, 1952, Bradford City won, York City won. Billy Fenton, I think, scored for York City. Now, I was going to presume that it was Bradford Park Avenue giving your support for that team, but it is Bradford City. So talk us through your first game and your early love for football.
Yeah, it's very strange, isn't it? My father was more of a Bradford City fan than Park Avenue. And he decided to take me to this game in York City. And I can remember the build-up because there was a lot of talk about David Dunmore, the star centre-forward for York, possibly leaving. Anyway, I got to the game and I can remember being... I was only a little boy, of course. You know, I was just 10 years of age. And I got passed down, handed down to the front behind the net, as happened with little toddlers in those days. And I can remember two or three players distinctively. I think that always happens, doesn't it, that a guy on the left wing for Bradford City, and funnily enough, Billy Fenton on the left wing for York. And he may well be the one who scored the first goal in professional football I've ever seen. It did finish 1-1, and I'm not sure whether Fenton scored first or Bradford City scored first. But, you know, I've got indelible memories of that game. The two Spence brothers, they were playing. Story, who I got to see in later life as well. But then a few weeks later, Park Avenue were playing Accrington Stanley. And my school took me to watch Yorkshire play Australia at cricket at Park Avenue in the days of Len Hutton and Keith Miller for Australia. Australia got a massive score. Miller made about 156. And then our hero Hutton went into bat for the last two overs of the day and got clean bowled by Ray Lindewall for naught. But I just fell in love with the atmosphere of Park Avenue. The football on one side of the main stand, cricket on the other. And I thought, this is idyllic. You know, this is going to be my paradise. And so I went back to my dad, a bit shamefaced, and said, sorry, Dad, but I'm going to be a Park Avenue fan. And he didn't mind in the slightest. He wasn't that massive a fan. He probably preferred cricket more than football, but he wanted me to experience professional football. So it was at Valley Parade that I saw my first game, but I absolutely fell in love with Park Avenue.
Yeah, and that was 1952, wasn't it? So I know it was a year later, but I wondered whether 1953 was quite a significant year for you, with it being the famous Stanley Matthews FA Cup final and Blackpool beating Bolton 4-3.
1953 was a massive year, I think, for anybody who was in love with sport. And that cricket match I referred to was in 1953. That was the Australian touring team, but it came after my first Bradford City York game and just before Bradford Park Avenue played Accrington Stanley. But the 53 Cup final, Blackpool and Bolton Wanderers, is etched in my mind and will be forever. There weren't many television sets around in those days, but my next door neighbours, Mr and Mrs Kettlewell, had one, and I got on quite well with their daughter, and I got invited to go and watch the cup final on that Saturday afternoon, and it was just an absolute epic. I mean, I think it is still regarded as the best ever FA Cup final, with Stanley Matthews laying on a hat-trick for Stanley Mortensen, Blackpool coming from 3-1 down with about 15 minutes to play to win 4-3. Matthews being carried off shoulder high. And it was in black and white, of course, in those days. But it left this incredible mark, not just on me, but for thousands of people, probably millions around the world, you know, although television, of course, wasn't going around the world in those days, but they've subsequently seen the pictures. And it really was a game changer for many, many people. A lot of people fell in love with football because of that one very, very fine match.
Yeah, I think I read that you used to run around commentating on yourself, dribbling a tennis ball on the way to school, and people called you Stan because of it. Is that right?
Absolutely. You've caught me grinning there, because that's spot on. Yeah, my school teacher, Mrs. Dunwell, said that I was destined to be a commentator even at the age of 10 or 11, because I used to commentate on the games, dribbling a little tennis ball. And in the playground at lunchtime for cricket, I was Len Hutton. You know, so I was a combination of Stanley Matthews and Len Hutton. It was the Stan that stuck. And there are still people in Bailden, where I live, who call me Stan, you know, from school days. Very funny when you think back to that.
Yeah, must have planted a seed. And you started being a journalist in 1959, and that was at the Shipley Times. Just tell us a story about your first day and how you managed to get a real big scoop.
I don't know if the word scoop is correct, but what happened was the phone rang. You're right, Shipley Times and Express. There were two local papers in Shipley, a small town, but on the Wednesday, the Shipley Times and Express came out, and on the Friday, there was a Shipley Guardian, our direct rival. Anyway, my first day, the phone rang, and being so eager as a 17-year-old, I grabbed it, and it was a voice I knew, and he said, I know it's your first day, John. I've got a bit of a story for you. So I said, oh, thank you very much. He said, Councillor Sucksmith died last night, who was a very well-known local person. So I shot into the editor, Mr. Mitchell, and said, Councillor Sucksmith apparently died last night, Mr. Mitchell. He said, well, you write the story, and that will be your first article ever. He says, go to the file and find out everything about Miss Councillor Sucksmith and write it up. I did. It appeared on the Wednesday, and in the afternoon, the phone rang again, and still eager, I grabbed it. Hello, John. It's Councillor Sucksmith here. I never knew I was so well respected. Unfortunately, he saw the funny side of it, but it taught me a lesson literally in my very first week about checking facts. But that is absolutely true. Councillor Harold Sucksmith.
The 1966 World Cup win, I know you were kind of working as a journalist then, but how vivid are your memories of that particular kind of tournament and England winning it?
Well, the incredible thing was I was actually playing cricket in the Bradford League for Bayledon that day. And we were playing, I think it was either Great Houghton or Queensbury. And astonishingly, both teams were all out for 32 and the match finished at 10-3. How convenient was that? I'm not suggesting there was any collusion, but we got quickly changed and we're in the clubhouse for the kickoff at 3 o'clock. And then, of course, I remember just a nation in ecstasy. And it was still, all these years on, it was still our greatest moment in world football. And those names, the 11 names, became synonymous with the sport for the rest of their lives and for all the years that we've revered them and tried to replicate it and failed miserably so far to do so. But yeah, it was one of the greatest days of a watching life that I've enjoyed, obviously.
And you got to know people like Jack Charlton really well, didn't you, later on when he was manager of Ireland?
Yeah, Jack, he worked for me at Radio Leeds. He did a programme called Jack's Track, where he went out with a tape recorder. He went to Roundtree's factory in York, funnily enough. He went to a glass-blowing factory. The funniest one, he went poaching one night into the wilds, and he charged me the incredible sum of £120 expenses for 10 programmes. And then, of course, I got to know Jimmy Greaves, who was Saint and Greavesy, where I appeared on that quite a few times. And yeah, many of that team became really firm friends.
So before you were kind of involved in sport, I think you'd spent 11 years, hadn't you, with the Shipley Times and then I think with the Yorkshire Post before the BBC came calling, you became sports editor for Radio Leeds. Were those sort of formative years quite integral really to the next phase of your career? Did they have sort of transferable skills?
Well, absolutely vital. It was 7 years on the Shipley Times and 4 years on the Yorkshire Post and Evening Post. So those 7 years were spent covering court cases, covering local council meetings, walking miles every Monday, sometimes in the pouring rain, just to get news from the local parish church or whatever it may be. And then the 4 years on the and covering sport for the first time. I used to cover a football team called Salts from Saltaire, associated with the mill. And they were a decent team. They were in the Yorkshire League and they played, funnily enough, they played in the FA Amateur Cup, lost 10-0 to Corinthian Casuals and lost 6-1 to Loughborough Colleges, whose goalkeeper was Bob Wilson, who I got to know very much in later life, formerly of Arsenal, of course, and ITV. And then the 4 years on the Yorkshire Post, again, I was a general news reporter, but whenever there was a big sports story, they often gave it to me. They had a sports department, obviously, but they knew that I'd got decent connections, a love of sport, and so I even went to Anfield on the night when Leeds United won the First Division Championship title for the first time. I was sent to interview a chap called Jeff Cope, who'd been banned from playing cricket because of his action, and he became a lifelong friend. So I've got fantastic memories of both my 7 years on the weekly paper and 4 years working for a daily paper. And I think it's absolutely vital that any young aspiring journalist or broadcaster has exactly that sort of training. You've got to do the hard yards. You've got to go through the mill, hopefully to get somewhere near the top.
Yeah. And am I right in thinking as well that your commentary career actually got started at the Commonwealth Games, didn't it? And football commentary came much later on.
Yeah, I would say, I wouldn't say my commentary career started. I would say that it was the biggest break I had in broadcasting. I'd been at Radio Leeds since 1970. I joined on the day that Leeds played Chelsea in the FA Cup final, a 2-2 draw at Wembley. And I was, as you say, the sports editor of Radio Leeds. So I was covering probably best team in Europe, Leeds United at that time. Well, certainly one of the top two or three teams in Europe. I was covering Yorkshire cricket. I was covering rugby league. So I was doing a lot of broadcasting. But then in 1974, I got a phone call from a chap called Roger McDonald, who worked in London for the BBC, saying that I'd been nominated to represent all 20 local radio stations at the Commonwealth Games in Christchurch, which I felt was an honour. And so I went out to New Zealand and had the time of my life. Absolutely wonderful. Covering all sports, you know, from Crown Green Bowls and interviewing David Bryant, who was the star in the sport at that time, through to doing the boxing, to the athletics, interviewing so many. David Bedford was the hottest runner in town at that time. And I did something like 170 pieces for the 20 local radio stations in the time I was there. Believe it or not, I actually got to play cricket on the Lancaster Park Test Ground as well. And it just left wonderful memories. But when I got home, well, Cliff Morgan was the head of outside broadcasts, and unbeknown to me, he invited my wife down to London for the day I flew back in. I appeared on what is now Five Live, Saturday afternoon show, was interviewed, and he offered me a permanent job in London, working with the likes of Peter Jones and Brian Butler and Des Lynam, you know, wonderful broadcasters. And so that's why I say it was the defining moment of my entire career, 1974, Christchurch.
Yeah, and it brings me nicely to the next question, because I was going to mention about there's a lot of other sports that you've kind of done in your career other than football, isn't there? Like water polo. So you're known for someone who's got, you know, great enthusiasm, and clearly you've still got enthusiasm now commentating. But how do you portray that for a sport that you're not as familiar with? So you haven't got that kind of, you haven't grown up with water polo, as it were.
It's a very good question. What I always say is that you concentrate more on a sport that you're unfamiliar with than the ones that you're really familiar with. I grew up with cricket, football, rugby league, and then inherited golf as well. I'd always played golf, so I was comfortable with those four sports. But then all of a sudden, I was thrust into doing all manner of things. I remember at Radio Leeds once, I attempted to do greyhound racing, and I got one letter, no emails in those days. I got one letter saying, stick to football. And he was absolutely spot on. But then I realised that I was going to get asked to do some of what wrongly probably are called minority sports, you know, like you say, water polo and water skiing. I did horse racing, sometimes presenting rather than interviewing. And one that really probably brought it home was when I did the figure skating, the world figure skating and European figure skating, the year after Torvald and Dean were the world champions, and ITV wanted me to present it. So I thought, well, I'm going to get asked to do things like this. You're going to have to swat up more than you've ever done. So I got hold of some of the top people in each of these sports. When I did rowing and canoeing at the 88 Seoul Olympics, I got the head of the association. I went to speak to people like Steve Redgrave, so that I felt more comfortable when I was actually on air. And I think that, well, I like to think that paid off, and that's still happening to this day. You mentioned water polo. I've done the last four World Water Polo Championships. I loved it. I mean, when you're watching the best of the best, it doesn't matter whether it's skiing or archery. You're privileged, and you know you're watching the best of the best in the world. And it's a fantastic privilege to be able to do that. And I've loved, and I've sort of broadcast the fact to other people who might laugh or scoff even at some of these other sports, until I say to them, look, if you're there, you get wrapped up in it and you realize just how good these people are at their specialized sport.
And there won't have been any sort of formal training as such in those days. I'd imagine there's probably courses at universities now that people can take to be a commentator. So were you always kind of confident of being able to find your voice, as it were?
Well, when I was a lad, I always remember at Christmas time, I used to go and spend some time with my uncle in Benridding near Ilkley over Christmas. And I always remember listening to the radio and to Rugby Union Internationals at that time. I prefer rugby league, everybody knows that. And I thought how good they were. And I loved Test Match Special with John Arlott and Brian Johnston and people like that. And I actually got to produce Test Match Special just for one series against the West Indies. And I really thought, well, I've hit the heights now that I'm producing, I'm working with people like John Arlott. And what I tried to do was to learn from them. by listening to them, by talking to them, to wanting to be as good as them. And on the day that John Arlott retired and did his last commentary, I was his producer. And I asked him for some advice. And the play was halted, it rained off. And we went and spent an hour or two in his bedroom over a bottle of red wine, I don't mind admitting, and some cheese and biscuits and some pâté and toast. And we just talked for an hour about what made great broadcasters. And I've never, ever forgotten that. And equally, I learned from people like Peter Jones in football, Peter Alice in golf. And I think you've always got to be willing. You're only as good as your last broadcast, you know. And I approach that today to everyone that I go into now. I always think, well, it doesn't matter what you've achieved, what you've done in the past. This is the most important day. This has got to be as good as you've ever done. And I try to follow that philosophy.
Yeah, a great philosophy to have. And it must have been a great time to be involved with Radio Leeds. I mean, you touched upon there about Yorkshire Cricket, Leeds United, Rugby League. And I think they were all doing really well at that time as well, weren't they? So it must have been a real good sort of feel-good factor around Radio Leeds around that period.
They were all champions. And the amazing thing is, to this day, they all got on famously together. I mentioned Jeff Cope, and he was very much a catalyst of this, along with people like John Atkinson and Alan Smith at Leeds Rugby League. And of course, he was with Yorkshire. He got to know Norman Hunter and Peter Lorimer and Eddie Gray and Gordon McQueen. And they all mixed socially. That was the amazing thing. There was one dinner. I remember the Lord Mayor of Leeds, I think, had the nous to say, let's get all this lot together. And at Leeds Civic Hall one year, they had all three, Leeds United, Leeds Rugby League and Yorkshire Cricket, celebrating all their individual triumphs, but as a joint entity sort of thing. And as I say, to this day, they are still in touch with one another, the players from that era. I'm not sure that happens nowadays, which is a bit of a shame, really.
Yeah. And your time at BBC Radio Leeds coincided with the likes of Don Revie and Brian Clough. And I'd imagine most people would have found Clough here, or at least he had a bit of an aura around him. So how did you find sort of speaking to him?
I actually got on quite well with Cloughy. The first meeting was when he came to Leeds United. I was there at the press conference when he was appointed, and it was quite extraordinary. He came into the room full of seasoned, grizzly old journalists. I wasn't grizzly, but a few of the other boys were. They'd been around the block a few times. And he picked up a coat hanger and started playing cricket shots and saying, hey, you lot, you know, you'd have been better off covering cricket than football. You don't want to come watch this little lot. They're all cheats. And we're like, goodness gracious me, how is he going to go and talk to these great players like Johnny Giles and Billy Bremner and Eddie Gray? I mean, it was extraordinary. But I got to work him out a little bit, and I was there on the day that he was sacked, and I was in the same room as him at the end doing an interview, and then he was ordering champagne to celebrate his sacking, and I'll keep the car, and he was just so eccentric. But then it stood me in good stead, because when I moved to London, that was obviously, you know, 73, 74 time. When I moved down to London, I became the football head of outside broadcasts with special responsibilities for football production. So I did the World Cup in Argentina in 78. And of course, Forest were the team in Europe, winning two European Cup finals against Malmo and Hamburg. And so I got to know him on very much an individual basis. And he'd always grant me an interview. And he'd always ask me, how long do you want? And I'd say, about 3 minutes, Brian. And on 3 minutes, he'd give me a fantastic outline. So that's why I'm the best in the business. And press the button down to end the interview. There you go, you've got another jewel. He was an extraordinary man, but I like to think that he quite liked me. And we got on reasonably well, despite everything.
Yeah, well, you must have done for him to keep granting you interviews. And he's one of many sort of famous people you've met and interviewed, isn't he? Like, I was looking through your kind of list of sort of Gazza, Muhammad Ali, Nelson Mandela. I mean, it must give you an enormous sense of pride, fantastic memories, but also a brilliant ability to sort of name drop.
Well, the funny thing is, I don't know if you can see this, but there is Nelson Mandela with me at the interview in my bedroom at home. Yeah, I've been very privileged. I mean, I've met Pele, I've met Muhammad Ali, as you mentioned. Nelson Mandela was massive, obviously. Some of my favourite interviewees were in different sports, people like Arnold Palmer, who's probably one of the greatest golfers of all time. Tiger Woods, who's without question one of the greatest sportsmen of all time. I saw Usain Bolt break a world record, and just before he went out onto the track, I bumped into him in the training gym. So I've had some very, very special moments. And I just consider myself extremely fortunate here in that I've had longevity as well. My health's pretty good. I'm still working every week. seen some of the greatest sporting moments. I always say the 1977 Open Golf Championship at Turnberry, when I was the one commentating all the way on the last round with Tom Watson and Jack Nicklaus, was one of the best things I've ever seen in my life as a devotee of golf and somebody who appreciates how good these fellas are at the side of me. I'm absolutely useless compared to them. So, you know, that's been the privilege, the length of the career, and seeing some of the greatest sporting moments of all time.
Yeah, and you're in what many feel is like a golden era of commentators and broadcasters, and you mentioned quite a lot of them earlier on, but thinking like Brian Moore, Peter Jones, Barry Davis, John Motson, Richie Beno in cricket, I wondered, was there ever sort of rivalries between you, or was there just respect between you all? I imagine someone like Richie Beno, you probably couldn't have anything other than respect for him.
No, absolutely. And I still say he's come out with the best quote of all time. If you can't add something to the picture, don't say anything at all. He's spot on. And for me, we don't like comparing eras. I do appreciate that commentary moves on and commentary styles move on. But Peter Jones always used to say, let it breathe, light and shade, where too many modern commentators feel they've got to talk every second of every commentary match. You've got to have some pauses and then build up to the climax, to the really critical moment where some are on the ceiling right throughout the match, even over a throw-in. But yeah, again, the question you really asked me there was about whether there was competition or respect. The only competition came in the fact that one of you worked for BBC and one of you worked for ITV, maybe. So the competition was between the organisations. But individually, no. I mean, I used to help Motti out, and Motti would help me out at times if it was possible. I can remember occasions with both. And I do like to think we did have respect for one another. But we used to help one another as well, you know. And that still happens. Even now, to this day, I had a message from Peter Drury about something last week. He was asking me for some help on something, which I was only too privileged to give him. And the same happened with people like, you know, Jim Rosenthal and Alan Parry and Peter Brackley, who sadly no longer with us. But then we'd help out John Motson and Barry Davis, even though they worked for BBC, and that was when I was at ITV. Yeah, no, it's a great fraternity, to be honest. Maybe a little bit more competitive nowadays. I'm not sure. I'm not quite sure they fraternise as much. We used to go and have a drink together. I'm not sure that happens. I might be wrong, actually. But I think what is true, Dan, is that we had a greater relationship with the managers and the players at that time. I used to have the phone number of every player in what is now the Premier League, every England footballer, you know, your Kevin Keegans and your Ray Clemences and your Brian Robsons. And we used to go out and have a drink together. And we certainly used to have social occasions where we'd mix with the managers, you know, the Ron Atkinsons and the Graham Taylors of this world, Don Revie, certainly. I don't think that it can't happen in the modern world, sadly, from my perspective.
Yeah. And you grew up loving the Bradford Park Avenue team, but I know another team you really loved was the Brazil side of 1982, because you covered all of their games in Spain and the World Cup. So what was it that you loved about that team?
Vibrancy, colour, brilliance, absolute skill to the maximum. They were individually fantastic, and as a team, even more fantastic. And that's a rare combination. You can often have great players who might not be in the best teams. You know, you could have Lionel Messi, and he might not play on the best side. He was at Barcelona. But I think at that Brazilian side, people even to this day revere the names Zico, Socrates, Falcao, Eder, Junior, and the names rolled off the tongue.
Zico. Oh, lovely ball to Junior. What a goal it will be. That was pure gold.
With all due respect to Bulgarians or Poles or Tunisians or whatever it might be, the names do not roll off the tongue like those Brazilian names did. Zico became quite a friend of mine because he was managing Goa in the Indian Super League when I was out there commentating. Socrates, of course, came to play over in this country. And there was just an aura about them. Every match they played in, the sun was shining, their spectators were beautiful people, full of character, full of colour. And it was just the way they played the game. I thought it was tragic that they didn't win that World Cup, because it would have set a tone and a trend for the rest of the world. With all due respect to Italy, who knocked them out with a Paolo Rossi hat-trick, they weren't as sexy as Brazil. Brazil were sexy. There's no question about it. There's no other way of putting it either. You know, you would pay to watch them every day of the week.
And I remember sort of growing up listening to my dad saying about World Cups, and he sort of talked about the difference between sort of now and then. And he said there was almost an air of mystery about these players from the likes of Brazil or Argentina. You didn't know who they were. Whereas now, obviously, you've got wall-to-wall coverage of different leagues around the world. So you could probably name the Brazil 1 to 11, as it were. I suppose that would have been a bit of a thrill for being a commentator too, as well. Is that kind of missing now, that you do know everyone? You almost know too much with information at your fingertips.
Yeah, I think it's a fair point, and it is specifically too in cricket as well. When I mentioned Australia in 1953 and names like Ray Lindwall and the other Keith Miller, they were wonderful, wonderful players and had more of an aura about them because they only came every 4 years. And you didn't read Australian cricket scores in those days. We didn't have the internet. We didn't have things like podcasts in that time, of course. So there was a colossal aura about them and Weeks and Walcott and Worrall, the three West Indians who came to play. But then now you can see those players play cricket in the Sunday League or whatever it's called nowadays, your Gillette Cup or whatever. You can see them every day of the week in this country, and you can see video clips of them all the time. So that aura just doesn't exist in footballing terms. You know, I remember after the Argentina World Cup in 1978, the story when Ozzy Ardiles and Villa came to this country to play for Tottenham Hotspur, people were astonished that Argentinian footballers were coming to play in England. Now you could go to Crawley Town against Stevenage and there'd be foreigners galore on the pitch. You know, so that mystique has disappeared. Yeah. It's a shame, but the world moves on and we all have travelled the world. I hope you have done. Yeah. We have to appreciate that life is very, very different. It's far more accessible in one sense. You can get on a flight and go to Thailand if you want. That didn't happen in those sort of days. So it's better in one respect and it's not as good in the other.
And is commentating at a World Cup, and I think you did about 10. Is that the pinnacle of your career?
Yes, I would think so. If somebody had said to me when I was a small boy, you get to cover 10 World Cups, you know, all in different continents and in different countries around the world, and I visited 90 countries in the course of my work, I think I'd have snapped their hands off. So, yeah, I think for anybody who's a football commentator, to be asked to cover the World Cup final itself, and I did five or six anyway, some five on site and one in a studio in the USA. 94, I did the final in a studio, but the other five were actually on site in the stadium, and you feel at the time, well, this is going to be as good as it gets in my career, to commentate at the World Cup final itself to an audience of something like 80 million, 100 million or something is very, very satisfying, shall we say.
I can imagine, and I think one of the beauties of commentary is that there's no script, is there? I mean, you can plan for facts and information that you might drop in during the game, but ultimately your fate and the words that you come out with is in the hands or feet of those on the pitch. So when you say, Laudrup, the boy's a genius, like you did in the 1986 World Cup, you would have no idea how much those words were going to mean to a particular community.
Laudrup, it's just the Ghostbusters defenders as though they don't exist. This is going to be one of the goals of the tournament. Magnificent. The boy's a genius. Defence as though it almost didn't exist. It was too easy for him.
You've done your research, haven't you? Yeah, they actually made T-shirts of the boys of genius in Denmark. You look back and there are two or three commentary lines which are, I have to say, and this is crucial, never rehearsed. Your best lines are always off the top of your head, totally spontaneous. You can usually tell if a commentator has had a preordained line that he's determined to get in. So I always advise aspiring young commentators, don't ever script commentary because it's so blatant, people can tell. So it's got to be spontaneous. And I think that is the beauty of commentary as opposed to written script, that you really... It's your passion that comes out, your passion for the sport, your passion for that particular moment. And that's why I say you can't rehearse it. It's got to be instinctive. And I think people appreciate that.
Yeah. And you love Brazil, Bradford Park Avenue. I love York City, particular fondness for the team that got me hooked, which was the early 90s. And so I wondered what your memories were of covering York City around that time, because I think you commentated on our first ever game at Wembley. There was League Cup successes over Man United and Everton that I think you covered. And I grew up hearing you covering games on Goals on Sunday quite regularly from Booth and Crescent too.
I've scribbled down half a dozen. There was once again when I was a boy, and I went with my dad, and York were a goal up, and it was the 89th minute, and there wasn't much added time in those days, and we left. And as we were going out the ground, there was a massive roar. And about another minute later, there was another massive roar, and Avenue had won 2-1. There's a thing there, isn't there? Never, ever leave a game early. I very rarely do. Then I remember a game against Aston Villa back in the 70s, League Cup game, which was won by a John Peachey goal. Then the next round, they played Manchester City. That was a 0-0 draw. I remember the famous Liverpool match, of course, where Peter Willis, the referee, were clearing the pitch of snow. And that was a 1-1 draw, wasn't it? And then in the replay, 7-0. Ricky Sprazier scored to make it 1-1, and then they lost 7-0 at Anfield. To go the other way, I then remember them losing an FA Cup tie at home to Carnarvon Town. And you think, oh, dearie me, how can we go from Manchester City to Carnarvon Town? But you're right, the playoff, where they'd beaten Bury with a Gary Swan goal in the playoff semi-final, and then at Wembley, it was Swan again who scored to make it 1-1 against Crewe Alexandra. And of all unlikely heroes, I hope you'd excuse me saying this because I know he's still around, Wayne Hall was the hero in the penalty shootout.
Hall. He'll be left-footed. The other York penalties were all taken with the right foot. Now, it's Wayne Hall. He's got one goal all season. He's won them promotion! It's one of the greatest days in the history of York City. They'll play in Division 2 next season.
I'll never forget that. I'll never forget a 1996 cup tie against Everton. A good pal of mine, the best co-commentator I ever worked with, was Joe Royal, who was the Everton manager at the time, and York beat them 3-2. He was absolutely furious, livid, any word you wanted to come up with. That was Joe. He wouldn't even speak to me, and he was a good pal of mine. There was a Manchester United Cup tie as well, which was lost 3-1. And then the more recent memories are the sadder ones, because I saw them lose at home to Scarborough, of all clubs, in the conference, and in the Blue Square Premier, saw them playing away at Farsley Celtic. And, you know, they were up against teams in the National League, like in National League North, like Chorley and Spennymoor and my own Bradford Park Avenue not that long ago. So it's great to see them in a challenging position again now. And I just hope they do it and get back into the Football League this time.
Yeah, and what's your sort of memories of Booth and Crescent as a ground to commentate at as well? Did a few commentaries myself there, and it wasn't the best of facilities, but I suppose when I was doing it, it was sort of towards the end of its sort of time at Booth and Crescent. You'll have been there when it was probably a little bit more updated.
Yeah, it needed updating, of course, but it was atmospheric. And for TV, it was better than it was for radio, to be honest, because I used to be on the opposite side of the ground to where the teams came out, and you had a good view. You were literally on top of that stand. I remember one day the ball came up and my cameraman Gary Kane headed it back into play, which was a great moment there. And that was a good view, and it was tight, it was a packed environment, it made plenty of noise. But latterly, I used to go and watch rugby league there as well, but it was definitely looking a little bit worse for wear. So they've moved to the new LNER Community Stadium, which I've been to several times and thoroughly enjoyed. It's a very colourful ground. And that's why I say I wish them all the best. But those Booth and Crescent memories are probably most of those cup ties, the Liverpool, the Manchester City and the Aston Villa ones, which are going back. I don't quite go back, although I remember the team well, to the Arthur Bottom days and the FA Cup semi-final against Newcastle. Yeah, I used to be able to rattle that team off. Forgan, Phillips, Howe, Brown, Patrick, Spence, Hughes, Bottom, Wilkinson, Story, Fenton. There you go. How's that?
Pretty good. And it must be a real privilege, I was thinking, to sort of commentate on local Yorkshire teams in their sort of special moments, thinking you've covered like Barnsley's promotion to the Premier League. You'll have had similar special times with sort of Doncaster, Scunthorpe, and your voice will be the one that fans will cherish and associate with special periods in their club's history, because that's what's on the footage.
Well, it's very kind of you to say so. I thoroughly enjoyed my time at Yorkshire Television, which was from 1981 to around 2012. And even in the last few years, where I've been working for the Mail on Sunday, or I've been doing odd games for odd companies, I've always tried to stay in touch with every one of those clubs. So, you know, once or twice a season, I've gone to Grimsby Town, I've gone to Mansfield Town, which is part of our region, to Chesterfield. And I've always been greeted with a warm welcome, which I'm very grateful for. This year's been a bit difficult. I don't know if you know, but I've been covering Lincoln City home and away. They came up at the start of this season and asked me if I fancied doing some games for them. I said, yeah, why not? I'd done three pre-season matches for them last year, and they asked me to do every match, home and away. So here I am, yeah, following the on Imps Plus on the streaming service with a team that's top of the table and about to get into the championship, which has been equally fantastic. It's another chapter in my career at the age of 83, which I could never have dreamt about.
Absolutely incredible. And we've discussed many highs of your career, but undoubtedly the biggest low was commentating during the Bradford City fire, where 56 people tragically lost their lives. And a game that you should have been covering, a celebration of Bradford achieving promotion. I know you can't watch the footage back, which is totally understandable, but obviously researching this, I did. And what struck me was your ability to sort of remain quite measured and get that balance right of sort of people seeing the pictures and you talking over them. And I kind of wondered if that was you sort of consciously or subconsciously reverting back to your sort of journalist days, because it's gone from sport to real life in literally sort of, what, 2 minutes or sort of 4 minutes, I think, from it being a small fire to the whole stand not being there. And is my observations right on that? Were you kind of going back to your sort of journalism days there, and that sort of helped you in that situation?
Yeah, very much so. At that moment, I was so grateful for the 7 years I'd had on the Shipley Times and Express, and the 4 years on the Yorkshire Post, and the time at Radio Leeds and Five Live. I think it all coming together helped me. And you're right when you said it was subconscious, because you're just so aghast at what you're watching at the time. It was so vivid. I mean, the memories are still there, the plumes of smoke and the people desperately trying to get away from hell. You're never going to lose that. And I've always said, I'll always talk about it, but you're right to say I can't bear to watch the footage. I really can't. All I was trying to do, and I have to say, I always pay tribute to the director on that day, Peter Jones, who's sadly no longer with us. He kept me calm. He kept talking to me and said, just keep talking, keep going. You know, you're doing fine, just keep going. He never, ever told me that it was going out across the world. I mean, those pictures were being beamed to the United States at that time. It was such a ferocious vision. But you're quite right to say that my journalistic training, I like to think, stood me in good stead. And all I was conscious of doing was trying not to over-dramatise the pictures. Going back to Richie Benno, the pictures were so dramatic, the fewer the words, the better. But every now and again, you'd have to contribute something. So, you know, when I saw the poor chap on fire, you know, I said, oh, the poor man. That's just a human reaction. But trying not to over-dramatise. How could you over-dramatise something as phenomenally horrible as that? And my only satisfaction was that most people seem to think that Yorkshire Television got it right and the way we treated it. Eventually, we were able to turn the cameras off. The most hurtful thing for me was that a group of fans, and I understand it, they were caught up in the hysteria, came across to the side of the pitch where I was, obviously on the opposite side to the main stand, and started throwing stones at me and sat shouting, switch your so-and-so cameras off. Well, it's been proved many a time since that we did the right thing to keep those cameras rolling, because the footage has been used by all the emergency services, police, ambulance, fire, to this day in training, and possibly has saved many a life by people know what to do better. And the other outcome, of course, has been that there are no stadiums like that in the world now, completely wooden stands. People are not allowed to smoke in sporting stadia anymore. So, you know, if we played a tiny little part in helping change history in the way football is dealt with in that respect, then, you know, at least I'm a little bit relieved by that.
Yeah, of course. And it must have been extra difficult for you as well. I was thinking, you know, being in Bradford, a city so close to your heart, and did you find that it sort of changed your outlook on life and sort of commentating as well?
It certainly made me think. I knew a lot of the people in there, and due to this day, obviously I lost quite a few friends myself that day of the 56. And it's so ironic that I'm now working for Lincoln City, who were the opposition on that day. I always felt for them as well, because they lost two supporters on that day. And people tended to forget that Lincoln had an involvement. But it has created a bond between the two clubs, Bradford City and Lincoln City, which was very evident when they played one another about 6 weeks ago. I was actually asked by Lincoln to represent them in the laying of the wreath, which I took as a bit of a tribute, really. Thank you very much. And Bradford City's fans were very, very kind to me when we laid the wreaths. So, yeah, it gave me another view in life, I suppose. People said, how did I feel the next time I went back? Well, I felt okay because the ground didn't look the same. They'd rebuilt the stands. They were playing England in a friendly match, an England 11 selected by Bobby Robson. Kevin Keegan was playing, who I knew. It was a watershed moment, but I understand anybody who was there that day who has not been able to go back. It does look different, but, you know, those sentimental feelings are so brutal that you would understand anybody's philosophy of not wanting to return. But I've been okay.
Yeah, absolutely. And I did see that tribute from Lincoln at Bradford, and it was pretty special, wasn't it? And I know that there are rivalries in football, but all football fans agree that no one should ever go to a game and not come home. And I know you've always had an involvement with the kind of tributes to those that lost their lives that night, and have kind of done every year since.
Yes, people go every year on the anniversary, May the 11th, to Bradford. And one year I read out the names of the people who died, which is poignant. But I've always said I'll do anything I can in that regard, and contributing to the Burns unit at Bradford Royal Infirmary as well, where obviously there were people there straight after the match who I knew, and I had to go visiting for a few weeks. So I was always willing to do that. I was very happy to do that, and still am to this day. And I just think that Lincoln handled it very respectfully as well. And it's nice that we have two football clubs that do get on so well on and off the field.
Yeah, absolutely. And sort of moving back to more happier times, I suppose, in your career. And I noticed from researching that you've covered a lot of FIFA youth tournaments. And one of the games you covered was Portugal against Cameroon, which finished 5-5. And I think Portugal were 5-0 up and Cameroon equalised an injury. Tell us about that game. And is that the best game that you've ever commentated on?
Well, outside of the Brazil-Italy game in the World Cup of 82, yes, it's the most astonishing game. It was in Finland, you're right, in a place called Tampere, where I was able to walk from my hotel around a lake to the ground, which was fabulous. I used to love it. The weather was kind. And this match, Portugal only needed a draw to qualify for the next round. This was the last match in the preliminary round. Cameroon had to win it. And it was 4-0 at half-time. And I always say it included probably the best goal I've ever seen. One of the Portuguese players spotted the keeper off his line while he was in the centre circle and hooked the ball literally over his head and over the goalkeeper's head from about 50 yards out, which was amazing. It was 5-0 after 70 minutes, and Cameroon made a triple substitution and got it back to 5-5. Absolutely incredible. And within 15 minutes, and I also, if the match had lasted another 2 minutes, they would have won it. As it happened, Portugal got the point they needed to go through. What I didn't find out until the following day was that Portugal were so relaxed about it, they were convinced they were going to win anyway. They'd been out on the lash the night before and had a few, and it had caught up with them. But yes, it's certainly one of the most memorable games I've ever been at.
And I guess it must be quite special commentating on players who, at that stage, when they're in these kind of youth tournaments, because, you know, some of them will have gone on to have absolutely brilliant careers, but you're sort of seeing them before they emerge. It's almost like finding a band that no one's heard of before. And do you know what I mean? There's something sort of a little bit special about that, isn't there?
Yeah, I sometimes look back to who was playing. I saw Lionel Messi play in the under-17 World Cup in the Netherlands. I saw Sergio Aguero play for Argentina. I saw a wonderful Argentinian under-20 team in the year 2000, which included about four players who went on to have phenomenal careers. Some of them in this country, Colaccini, for example, who came to Newcastle United, he was in that team. Javier Saviola spent most of his career in Spain, but he became really top players. And you're right, it is. And the last one I was at was about 3 years ago in Argentina, funnily enough. And I saw two or three players there that you would expect to make massive names for themselves. And not just goal scorers, you know, midfield players, defenders. When you see quality at that age, it's absolutely wonderful. The sad thing for me was, I think only about once did I commentate on an England team. Having said that, I did do the under-17 World Cup final in 2017 in India, where we came from two down, England, two down after about 15 minutes against Spain to win 4-2. And Phil Foden and Jadon Sancho, Mark Guay, several others. We had an absolutely fantastic team. Oh, Gibbs White, Rose Smith-Rowe at Arsenal, Brewster, who came to Sheffield United, were all in that team. And it was, so I have commentated on an England World Cup final victory.
Well, there'll be another one in the summer. I remember Guy Mowbray saying to me once that the best work a commentator does is when it's nil-nil and it's a lot harder. He said, you know, you get these awards at the end of the season, it'll be someone who's commentated on a 4-3. And he said they're almost a bit easier because of what's happening on the pitch. But he says that the harder work is when you're covering a bit of a stinker. So I wondered if there was any in your career that sort of stand out as being, oh, that was a terrible match to commentate on, or do you just try to throw them into the back of your mind?
No, it's funny you should hit upon this one, because while you're asking the question, I've only ever twice got a rollicking, I think, for a commentary. Not a rollicking, actually. A sort of, that wasn't good enough, or it wasn't as good as usual. And one of them was Sunderland against Coventry at the old Roker Park, which was 0-0. And I'd got loads of stats. And thank God I've got all of that, because it was a totally unmemorable game. And the head of sport at ITV, well, he was the football editor, came on to me and said, you were determined to get every fact in. I said, well, there was nothing happening on the pitch, so I have to do. And the same fellow didn't like a commentary I did in the World Cup in USA between Republic of Ireland and Norway, where it was obvious that both teams were quite happy for a draw and literally passed the ball to one another. It was Jack Charlton's Republic of Ireland, and it was played in New York, and it was on a big pitch, and neither team was interested in winning it. I said, well, what was I supposed to do? You can't say this is a fraud. You know, they're just playing to get through to the next round with a 0-0. And you can't build up false excitement when they're just passing the ball between themselves across the halfway line. So I think people sometimes ought to have an understanding for commentators as well, that not every game is exciting. And sometimes we have to actually admit it.
Yeah. And as your career has grown, so have the stamps on your passport, haven't they? I think you mentioned earlier 90 plus sort of countries that you've been to. I mean, it must be a great privilege to travel all around the world covering a sport that you love. I mean, other than playing, I suppose it's kind of a dream, isn't it, really?
Well, I'm sitting in a spot in my house at the moment where I was in here one day and the phone went and I picked it up. It was a message and it said, World Beach Football, Honolulu. yes, definitely. I'm going on Tahiti. Tahiti. You know, when a message comes asking you to go to Tahiti, you don't exactly say no, do you? Whenever it is. If it's tomorrow, you're on the next flight. So, yeah, it's been wonderful. You know, I've been to half of the South American countries. I've been to about a dozen African countries. I've been down to Asia countless times. All the Japan, China, all of that. Thailand, I love it. And there have been some wonderful experiences. I love New Zealand. I love Canada as well, where my best pal from school emigrated. He's sadly no longer with us anymore. So there are your favourites. But on the other hand, there are one or two which I wouldn't describe as favourites. For example, I was in Nigeria once and I was actually playing golf, but there were crocodiles on the course and I had to have an armed guard with me. So that was quite an experience. And then I went to Nicaragua to do a CONCACAF tournament, women's under-17s, where you don't know a single player and there's nothing on the internet about them. And I was on the way back from the stadium to the hotel and all of a sudden I thought, this is very strange. There was nobody about. There was nobody on the streets. There was no shops open, no restaurants. And this is on a Saturday night at sort of 7 o'clock. Listen, got to the hotel, which was locked, no doors open, no gates open. Eventually somebody came and said, you can show us your pass. And I showed him the room key. He said, okay, you can come in. You won't be going out. There are 70 dead in the street out there, a military coup. So I have experienced one or two flip sides here, one or two countries that I'd rather have not been in at the time. But otherwise, it's been a fantastic privilege.
And one of the countries you travelled to a lot was India, wasn't it? You commentated on their kind of like Premier League that was kind of getting created. Do you ever get conscious of how many people are watching and listening? Because I know there was millions of people watching those games and I think even more so in COVID as well when people couldn't get to the game. So, and you mentioned earlier about how many millions are watching a World Cup final. Does that ever make you more nervous when you commentate, or is it just once you're with that mic, you just think of the game in front of you?
Not really. I imagine I'm talking to a chap at the bar or next door neighbour or something like that, trying to make it as informal as possible and yet as factual as possible. I don't think it would help your demeanour or your mental attitude if you were worried about talking to 80-odd million. You're going to make mistakes from time to time, and you accept, because it's the nature of our business, that not everybody's going to love you. That can't be, it can't be possible. I mean, I've got my favourites and people I'm not quite as keen on, without naming names. So I don't think it would do you any good, but it's nice to know how many are out there. So I used to ask when I used to do the Champions League, and there'd be a list of the countries that were taking the matches. You know, it might be Real Madrid against Inter Milan, and that'd have a colossal audience as well, down in Australia, New Zealand, America, people watching. So you're aware of the fact that millions are out there hanging. I won't say hanging on every word either, because one producer once said to me, probably only about a third of your commentary gets listened to by any one person, because they're on the move at the time. They're either making themselves a cup of tea or they're in an airport lounge watching, but they don't hang on every word. So never be nervous about the numbers that are ostensibly out there listening to every word that you're saying.
And I guess with sort of TV rather than radio commentary that you'd have done at the start, people are seeing the same pictures as you, aren't they? So does that almost put pressure on you to get it right? And do you remember times that you've got it wrong and people have kind of pointed it out to you? Do you get that more so as the years have gone on? Because I feel like everyone's now an expert.
Yeah, they are. I think it is more a modern thing than it used to be. And because you used to have that rapport with the managers and the players 20 years ago, shall I say, you were very, very much less likely to make a mistake than you are now. Plus the infiltration of foreign names into our game in this country. So I've always been extremely conscious of trying to get pronunciation right. So before a game involving a foreign team, I would always find somebody, it might not be the manager because they've got a lot on their minds, but it might be the physio or the kit man, just to run you through the pronunciations. Because I think it's so important that you at least make the best attempt you can to get it right. I'll never forget doing a World Cup match involving Poland, third place playoff it was in 1982 against France. And the goalkeeper of Poland was spelt M-L-Y-N-C-Z-A-R-E-K. Looks like Milinkzurek. So I went to check and it's pronounced Mlynarczyk. That rolls off the tongue, doesn't it? Mlynarczyk is not a problem. I did a game involving Thailand where the number four was called Sanaisriya Jasarapatarapong. Rolled off the tongue again, but only because I found out the correct way to pronounce it. And once you've got it, you're okay. But there are obviously certain, and in India, this is absolutely true. I did a game once and all 11 players were called Singh. Sing in goal, sing, sing, sing and sing at the back four, sing and sing in the midfield two, sing, sing and sing across the mid and sing the lone striker. So I didn't get a name wrong, although they did have names like Napoleon Sing and things like that. So you're very, very conscious of getting names right. People will be listening out for a horrendous mistake, which we will have all made. There's not a commentator alive who's not got a pronunciation wrong. And we have chats nowadays between ourselves, you know, how do you pronounce this guy? As soon as a new signing arrives from somewhere, everybody's on, how do you pronounce this one? There's a guy at Lincoln City this season coming from Ukraine called Vafolomeyev. And everybody now asks me, how do you pronounce Ivan? We'll call him Ivan. He's Vafolomeyev. So, yeah, you are aware that you're going to make mistakes. And if somebody tries to correct you, you just take it in good faith.
Yeah, and I think your legacy will undoubtedly be not just the sort of high quality of your work, but your longevity, which I think will be struggled to be matched, to be honest. You're commentating still every week for Lincoln City at the age of 83, which in a world where people say everything is a young man's game, and accusations of ageism and stuff, you must be delighted to still feel wanted.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's the reason I'm doing it in many ways, because it is still nice to be asked. And I'm hoping that they ask me for next year, especially if Lincoln are going to be playing in the Championship. It'll give me the opportunity to go back to grounds that I was at regularly years ago, like West Brom and Stoke and QPR and other teams, Millwall, as I have this season, where I've been to the likes of Wickham and Luton for the first time in donkey's years. But yeah, I am proud of the longevity. I do my best to try and keep fit. I go on a treadmill most mornings of a week, only for half an hour or 40 minutes. I don't run very fast, but it keeps me fit, and I have a reasonable diet. I still like a glass of wine, which I don't think there's any reason why I shouldn't. But yeah, I am proud of the longevity, if anything. Proud's the wrong word. It sounds a bit too much, doesn't it? But, you know, bit of your own backside-ish. But I'm pleased, shall we say that. I'm very, very pleased, Dan, to be talking to you today. Since 1959, I have a few stories to tell.
Well, that's it. And then you clearly still have the buzz and excitement, don't you? Which is so impressive, given you've covered games at such a high level that you seem just as happy to be commentating for Lincoln City. And I wonder with Lincoln City, do you And this is a thing that I do, like, still, I still think of it as Sinsel Bank. I don't even know what their ground is called. And you mentioned QPR and West Brom and Loftus Road. Do you still think of them in your head as what that ground was originally called?
Yeah, I do. And I sort of get special dispensation. The funny coincidence here is that you're a York City fan. Lincoln is the LNER Stadium. But I got a word very early on not to say LNER Community Stadium, which is York's official name. And sometimes I feel I do not want to say that's the Kentucky Fried Chicken Stadium or, you know, some absolutely ridiculous names. And I am old-fashioned. There's certain things I hate. I hate VAR. I don't mind admitting that. I've detested VAR from the first day because I think it takes away the passion of the game. That's why I've loved doing Lincoln, because when a goal is scored, you know it's a goal and you can say it's a goal. Premier League, it might be 5 minutes later, it's no longer a goal. So I've always retained my enthusiasm. I love meeting people within the game. I like to think whichever ground I go to, I'm going to bump into some old friend. It was a referee the other night. I went to Oldham Athletic on a horrible Tuesday night simply because I want to keep in touch with people. And George Kane, a referee from Liverpool, who's now as an assessor, greeted me like a long-lost brother, you know, and that's a big part of it for me. So the enthusiasm's still there. Tomorrow, for example, I'm going to Stockport County because they're playing Wimbledon and I'm commentating on Wimbledon next week. So research, it's so important. Never, ever ignore the fact that you've got to do your research. Otherwise, that is the day to pack in.
Yeah, and you mentioned VAR. That was one question I was going to ask you, because you're right about kind of like what it's like on the pitch. I always think a striker scoring a goal in the last minute, like whether it was Sergio Aguero to win Man City the Premier League title. I mean, that now just wouldn't happen in the same way, because you'd have to go, wouldn't you? And people can't celebrate like that. And I wonder if it's the same for you as a commentator, that your best moment commentating is going to be on a goal, isn't it? But then you're not quite sure whether it is a goal or not.
No, you're right. The boy's a genius, instinctive. And now I had a horrendous situation. When you said about being criticised, yes, I was in Club World Cup game a few years ago in Qatar, and a goal was scored to make it 2-0 from 1-0, and play didn't restart for a couple of minutes, and then they kicked off in the centre circle and it was still showing 2-0 on the screen, and a few minutes later it went back to 1-0. It had been disallowed, but the foul had been committed on the centre spot, literally, and nobody knew, you know. Now you feel a complete and utter idiot. Well, that's what I hate. And I have a bone of contention here. I don't think the scoreline caption on the screen should change until they kick off, because it's telling a lie for 3 or 4 minutes saying it's 2-0 when it's not. It never ever got to 2-0 because it was disallowed. It's a small point, but you know, I think it's a valid one. I really do. So, yeah, it has taken away that emotion. And I see more and more people seem to be coming around to my way of thinking as well. Just because they say, well, we've tried it, so we can't drop it now. Yes, you can. Works in cricket, works in rugby, doesn't work for me in football at all.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you say it works in cricket, because obviously cricket is a sport that you absolutely love as well, and it's been something that you've grown up with. So you've clearly embraced the technology in that sport, and think it's made it, enhanced it, but not in another sport that you love in football.
No, absolutely right. It's just not suitable for football. No.
Yeah. What I wanted to finish with, John, was your party piece that you are well known for. Now, I wondered if you could give us a bit of intro as to how this kind of came about, and then if you're still able to do it, it would be wonderful to hear.
Probably not as quickly as I used to do it.
Well, that'll be understandable.
We'll give it a go, Dan. I'll tell you how it happened. It was when I was working for what is now 5 Live, Radio 2 at that time down in London, and there was a programme called Brain of Sport, in which people came on and were incredibly knowledgeable about all sports. And they'd know things like there was a timekeeper at a boxing match in 1927. Ridiculous. Anyway, it was agreed that we should put a team up against them, and we had to sit an exam. Imagine all the Alan Parrish and the Jim Rosenthal's and all these people, Christopher Martin Jenkins. Mention Christopher. We actually got through. It was Des Lynam, Chris Martin Jenkins and myself were the three who got the most points in our exam. So we were the nominated team to take on that year's Brain of Sports top three in Leatherhead. And Peter Jones was the question master. So I just thought to add a bit of levity to proceedings, when it came to us, we should make it an entertaining broadcast. So I said, Jonesy, when you come to my first question, just ask me to name all the teams in the county cricket championship. He said, oh, it'll take a while. I said, no, it won't. It's Derbyshire, Durham, Essex, Glamorgan, Gloucestershire, Hampshire, Kent, Lancashire, Leicestershire, Middlesex, Northampton, not Somerset, Surrey, Sussex, Warwickshire, Worcestershire, Yorkshire. It took about 3 seconds. Oh, right. He said, you're a bit of a smart son. So I said, right. name all the 36 teams in the rugby league. I said, that's a bit harder. But there's Barron, Batley, Blackpool, Bradford, Bramley, Cardiff, Carlisle, Castleford, Chorley, Dewsbury, Doncaster, Featherstone, Fulham, Halifax, Huddersfield, Hull, Huncaston, Rovers, Hunslet, Highton, Keighley, Leeds, Lee, Nottingham, Oldham, Rochdale, Runcorn, St Helens, Salford, Sheffield, Swinton, Chafford, Wakefield, Warrington, Whitehead, Widnes, Wigan, Workington and York. So that took another 15 seconds or so. Oh, blimey, he says. Right, this will get you clever, son. So name all the 92 clubs in the Football League. And bearing in mind, this was 1981-82. So at that time, it was Arsenal, Aston Villa, Birmingham, Brighton, Coventry, Everton, Ipswich, Leeds, Liverpool, Man City, Man United, Middlesbrough, Nottingham Forest, Notts County, Southampton, Stoke, Sutton, Swansea, Tottenham, West Bromwich and Wolves, Barnsley, Blackburn, Bolton, Cambridge, Cardiff, Charlton, Chelsea, Crystal Palace, Derby, Grimsby, Leicester, Luton, Newcastle, Norwich, Oldham, Orient, QPR, Rotherham, Sheffield, Wednesday, Shrewsbury, Watford, Wrexham, Brentford, Bristol City, Bristol Rose, Burnley, Carlisle, Chester, Chesterfield, Doncaster, Exeter, Fulham, Gillingham, Huddersfield, Lincoln, Millwall, Newport, Oxford, Plymouth, Portsmouth, Preston, Reading, Southend, Swindon, Walsall, Wimbledon, Accrington, Barnet, Blackpool, Bournemouth, Bradford, Bury, Colchester, Crewe, Darlington, Halifax, Hartlepool, Hereford, Macclesfield, Mansfield, Northampton, Peterborough, Portvale, Rockdale, Scarborough, Scunthorpe, Sheffield United, Stockport, Torquay, Chamberlain, Wigan, Wickham and York. So there you are, I can still do it, but probably not as quickly as I did in those days.
Well, I timed it. It was 35 seconds, which I think for anyone in the world at 83 who can do that in 35 seconds, no one's beating that. It's incredible. And it's an incredible story as well. As have many of these stories, John. It's been fantastic to have you on. I've just sat in awe really listening to you and hope you've enjoyed kind of going over your memories of your career. It's a fantastic long career and you know, I'm glad you still got the enthusiasm for it. And I hope York City get promotion, but seconds of that, I hope Lincoln City do so you can go to those championship grounds next season.
And I hope Bradford Park Avenue get in the playoffs as well. In the Northern Premier League, still the first result I look for every Saturday night, Northern Premier League East, Bradford Park Avenue. We're just on the fringe of the playoffs at the minute. But no, I thoroughly enjoyed it. Dan, the funny thing about that, it got me on the Guinness Book of Records show with David Frost and Paul McCartney and Billie Jean King. So I've rubbed shoulders with a few people. Been a joy talking to you.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, then please consider making a donation to our charity via Just Giving. JustGiving.com/York Hospital Radio. You can also help us by subscribing and writing a review to help spread the word. Thank you for listening to York Hospital Radio Meets.
Your station, York Hospital Radio.